So here's this absurdly long title, which I typed in one day. It takes about 10 minutes to read it. Basically, there are three things I'm going to talk about. First, I'm going to talk about the galactic center region, the supermassive black hole there, and the possibilities of other binary black hole in the galactic center, and what it tells us about what's going on actually in the local group a little bit. Then I'm going to spend a bit of time on recent astrometry we do, where we're actually able to measure parallaxes and proper motions all across the Milky Way, the star-forming regions. What that tells us about spiral structure in the Milky Way, or what it will ultimately, and about star formation. There's kind of an interesting result in there. And then the last part will be a talk about the measurements of proper motions in the local group, which we're now undertaking and have some interesting results. So first, I'll give you one slide on how we do things. We use the very long baseline array, which is sort of schematically pictured there on the left in this nice artist conception. And it's an interferometer, and interferometers produce fringes. And the fringe spacing, or the angular resolution, if you like, of an interferometer is given by the wavelength divided by the separation of your elements. And so for the 1 centimeter wavelength, which is a characteristic wavelength we use, and about an 8,000 kilometer baseline, which we can get between St. Croix and the Virgin Islands and Hawaii and New England, that gives you a fringe spacing of about a quarter of a milliarc second, 250 micro arc seconds. So that's really, really pretty good. And if all you had to do was find the centroid of a bright spot, you can do it to that accuracy, about half the fringe spacing divided by the signal to noise. And even for modest signal to noises of, you know, a little over 10 to 1 here, you can see you divide that number by 2 and by 10, you get down to 10 micro arc seconds pretty easily. But of course, precision is not the game. It's you easily achieve that. It's always limited by systematics. And systematics with an interferometer always depend basically on measuring the path length between the two interferometer elements and controlling that. And basically, the advances we've made over the last 5 or so years have been to reduce those path length errors to about 2 centimeters. That's pretty good over 8,000 kilometers. And 2 centimeters is about 2 wavelengths. If you shift the path of an interferometer of one element with respect to the other by about 2 wavelengths, you shift positions on the sky by 2 fringes, which would be about 500 micro arc seconds. And that's, you know, not all that good, not terrible, but that's sure. Yeah.
On the precision, why is it half a fringe spacing?
Because that fringe spacing is a full width at half maximum. That's how we generally define it. It's really a sigma from a Gaussian,
okay.
And so and it's not exactly a half.
Okay.
It's got 4 root of pi in there and things like that.
What's changed in the past 5 years that you don't do this better?
Ah, okay. The thing that's changed. Yeah, anybody be interested here? Basically, the main source of error is sort of the measuring the path length above the telescope vertically through the atmosphere. It's the electronic delay of the signal through the atmosphere. And it's not short-term fluctuations. It's just sort of how much air you've got above you. It's actually how much water vapor above each telescope. And basically, we found ways to measure that during our experiments to about 1 centimeter accuracy. And we hadn't been doing that 10 years ago, and so things were about 5 times worse then than they are now.
Is it technological, or you just learn to do it better?
It's just learned how to do it better. Yeah. There was nothing really too deep into it, just a question of setting it up to do that calibration, finding out that it works, and applying it to the data. Okay. Now, so the point is, though, that we measure relative positions. We usually use background quasars, and then we have a target and a background quasar. And we measure the differential position between them. And our typical separation between the background quasar and our targets is about 1 degree on the sky, which if you can read way down at the bottom there, that's about 0.02 radian. So we cancel systematic errors by a factor of about 0.02. And so you put that together, the 500 micro arc second systematic error canceling by about 0.02, and we can get down to about 10 micro arc second relative position measurements against quasars. And that's what's opened up a whole new game. And I like to point out always that that's 10 microarc second measurements are comparable to Gaia, which is a future European Space Agency astrometric mission, sort of the follow-up to Hipparchos, and the US one SIM, Space Interferometry Mission, which is sort of dangling by a thread of NASA funding right now. These are obviously billion-plus dollar missions. We can do this right now. We can't do it to, for example, a billion sources, as Gaia will do, but Gaia is won't give you results for about another decade. And also, those are both optical missions. They can't see through the plane of the Milky Way. And for Milky Way science, you like to be able to do that. Okay, so by way of transition, I'd like to point out that, you know, not that long ago, in about 1920, we didn't even know where the center of the Milky Way was. And here's a picture of Harlow Shapley, who took measurements of the positions and distances of globular clusters. The globular cluster distances came from the new technique of getting Cepheid distances from period luminosity relations. He projected them down on the plane of the Milky Way. Obviously, you can't see them through the plane of the Milky Way because of dust. And made this plan view of the Milky Way, where the sun is at the center there, and the circles there are concentric circles of about 10 kiloparsec radius. And he noted that, of course, all the globular clusters are off to one side of the sun, and correctly concluded that the galactic center was probably given by the center of the globular cluster distributions. And he gave a distance of 13 kiloparsecs to the center of the Milky Way, which is really pretty good. It's about 8, considering 1920 and the calibrations were way off. There were actually some partially compensating systematic errors, which helped them out a bit. But really a very nice result. Okay, so if you move into the galactic center, I'm sure you all know about the measurements of the orbits of stars right in the galactic center. Just to summarize the results, there are two groups, Andrea Goetz's group at UCLA and Reinhard Genzel's group in Munich. They measure stars that are orbiting an unseen dark mass. Here's a picture made with a VLT of the galactic center region at 2 microns wavelength, where you get about 10% of the light through the dust. And the scale's pretty small here. It's about 10 arc seconds across here, or about a half a parsec. And if you didn't have this little arrow right here to tell you where the galactic center was, you really wouldn't have much of an idea about where the center of the Milky Way is. That's because in the infrared, almost all you see are stars. But if you blow things up quite a bit and look at the star, here's a star called S2, on about 100 times smaller scale than this whole slide now. It's been seen to go on an elliptical orbit with about a 16-year period. It's now done one complete revolution. The focal point of the orbit is right there, which I'll show you coincides with the position of Sagittarius A star, which is a bright radio source. From the orbit, you can determine that there's an enclosed mass of about 4 million solar masses that's unseen in the infrared. It has to be confined within a radius of about 50 astronomical units, so sort of the extended size of our solar system. And you get this rather astounding mass density if you put those numbers together of 10 to the 17th solar masses per cubic parsec, which is extremely strong evidence that it must be a supermassive black hole. But of course, what can radio observations tell us about all this? And it turns out quite a bit. So here's our two radio images of the galactic center region. On the left, it's an image made with the VLA. It shows that the center of the Milky Way is quite complex. This sort of dark blue stuff here, this looks like a supernova remnant called Sagittarius A East. The lighter green stuff here that forms sort of a mini spiral, as it's called, is ionized material that appears to be falling inward toward the galactic center. And if you go to a shorter wavelength to get higher angular resolution, you get this image on the right, where you can see this reddish stuff here is this mini, the inner part of this mini spiral right in there. So the scale of this image is about the same as the infrared image I showed you earlier. It's about half a parsec across. Now, on the infrared image, you saw lots of stars and not much else. On the radio image, you don't see any stars. Actually, you could detect one. There's this little faint thing up here, which is a bow shock from a red supergiant that was easily visible on the previous image. But you do see this very strong point-like source, which is Sagittarius A star. It's an unresolved source on the VLA image. It's quite strong. It's about a Jansky. And that is the exact center of the Milky Way. So
how do you know that?
I'll get to that. Okay. So one thing you'd like to do is you see this point-like radio source at the center of the Milky Way on radio images. You don't see it on infrared images. You'd like to transfer the position from the radio to the infrared so you'll know exactly where on those infrared images that source falls. That's not an easy thing to do. It turns out if you just take absolute coordinate systems, the infrared coordinate system and the radio coordinate system at the galactic center region will be off by about 1 or 2 tenths of an arc second. And 1 or 2 tenths of an arc second contains thousands of stars on that infrared image. So it's not good enough at all. So what you need to have sources that you can see both in the radio and the infrared simultaneously to allow you to register these images. And it turns out there's some really nice ones, red giant stars. Since they're red and giants, they're easily seen on infrared images. And the very nice thing is that they have molecular masers in their atmospheres, which you can see at radio wavelengths. And at the left here is sort of a composite spectrum of about a dozen or so infrared stars in the galactic center within about 15 arc seconds of the galactic center, showing the silicon monoxide maser emission, flux density versus Doppler shift velocity. At the right is an infrared image at 2 microns, black and white version. The stars that have these masers, the red giants, are circled over there, and we've actually measured the proper motions of those stars, both in the infrared and in the radio. And so all one has to do then is use the positions we determine in the radio, which are very accurate because radio interferometer positions are calculated in a computer. The final lens in a radio interferometer is a digital computer instead of a real piece of glass or something in an optical telescope. So we know the offset of all those stars relative to Sagittarius A star exceedingly accurately. So what one then does is take those positions, put them on top of the infrared image. It allows you with that grid of positions to calculate the plate scale and plate rotation in the infrared to exquisite accuracy. And then it's just a registration issue. You slide them until they agree. And you know where Sagittarius A star, which is circled there. Obviously, you don't see much in the infrared.
How good are the velocities?
The radial velocities?
Right.
So here's a spectrum. So for any one star, let's pick this one, which is nice and isolated. You can see they're spread over about 5 to 10 kilometers per second. We know the Doppler shift to much, you know, the rest frequency of the transition to essentially infinite accuracy. So it's really, what is the central velocity of that sort of lumpy spectrum? A couple kilometers per second.
I was thinking more of motions in the atmosphere. It's relative to most of the star itself.
Yeah, the SIO masers, it turns out, are very close into this stellar atmosphere, and they basically are moving at a few kilometers per second, both inward and outward, with respect to the star. So the answer is a few kilometers per second.
So not all red giants have masers in the atmosphere. What are the conditions to get?
They basically have to be a MIRA, a long period variable, okay, or a red supergiant. So they're typically a couple solar masses, and the red supergiants are pretty young objects, even though they're evolved. So for example, IRS-7 right there is a red supergiant. That was the one that had that little bow shock tail I referred to in an earlier talk. All the others in there are MIRA-like variables. Okay, so you can combine the astrometry from infrared and radio, and it turns out you can register the position of Sagittarius A star on the infrared images to about plus or minus 3 milliarcseconds, a big improvement over anything you could do with the absolute scales. And it turns out that the position agrees with the focal point of the orbits of all those stars measured in the infrared. Okay, so all the stars that are very close into the position of Sagittarius A star are observed to move very fast. That one that I showed you that had a complete orbit, when it passed Paris Center, it was moving about 8,000 kilometers per second. So any star in close to Sagittarius A star is moving in thousands of kilometers per second. The question is, how fast is Sagittarius A star moving? Well, this can be measured.
So for those on rest, do you see, is there any special about their distribution in orbits, or is it just random?
No, those are basically in random orbits. There are populations of other stars, not major stars,
right,
especially young stars, bluish stars, that do seem to be in a disk. And there's an argument about whether there's one or two disk populations, kind of tangential to this talk. But yes, there are certainly certain very interesting distributions. So here's a picture of the sky on the left. It's actually a radio image. The big black glob in the middle is the general Sagittarius A region. Sagittarius A star is circled there in the yellow, if you can see it right there. And what we do is we measure its position against two background quasars, one of them up here, and then one of them over there. They both are about 0.7 degrees away on the sky, which is very nice. They're pretty close. Now, what would we expect to see if we measure the position of Sagittarius A star with respect to, say, that quasar, which is the brighter of the two? The main thing we expect is that since we're orbiting the galactic center with about a 200 million year period, we would expect to see Sagittarius A star appear to move down toward the lower right because the sun is going the other direction. And it's sort of schematically shown up here. Well, what do we see? Okay, here's data that we published a few years ago, and I'll show you a little bit more later. Here is a picture of the sky. It's a pretty small piece of the sky. The major tick marks are 10 milliarcseconds apart, north up, east to the left. And relative to that northern quasar, Sagittarius A star in 1995 was up here. In 1996 it was here, it's 1997, and you can sort of see it moves on down. 2003 down there at the bottom, just as I said it should be moving, because we're on a moving platform orbiting the galactic center. It's actually kind of amazing, with the VLB array we can measure, or at least detect, the sun's orbit in the galaxy in less than a month, even though it takes 200 million years to go around. The dashed red line there is a weighted least square fit to that data, and it says that the apparent motion of Sagittarius A star is 6.379 milliarcseconds per year, with an uncertainty of about a third of 1%. You can convert that angular unit, angular motion, to sort of physical constants. It's basically, after a small correction for the motion of the sun, it's the rotation speed of the Milky Way at the sun, theta naught, divided by the distance to the galactic center, r naught. And in conventional units, it's 29.5 kilometers per second per kiloparsec. Remember that number. I'll remind you of it later. It turns up in a couple of things I'll be talking about. Now, I've also put a blue line on here. That is the orientation of the galactic plane. And you can see that the blue line differs from the red line significantly. And that's caused by the fact that the sun is moving northward out of the galactic plane at 7 kilometers per second. Very easily seen in this data. And so one thing one could obviously think about doing is redefining the galactic plane. If you're an IAU aficionado, the galactic plane was defined many years ago based on the distribution of neutral hydrogen. And for better or for worse, they said, we'll define the center of the plane where the sun is, which isn't very smart. The sun is known to be out of the galactic plane. From the IAU definition of the galactic plane, Sagittarius A star is out of the galactic plane. So you could actually make a dynamical definition of the galactic plane from this data and define effectively the plane by the orbit of the local standard of rest, and of course put Sagittarius A star in the galactic plane and the Sun out of the galactic plane. But that's sort of a sideline.
Wait, is the drift a fact that we're not in the galactic plane, or a fact that we're moving around the galactic plane?
We are both. The Sun is north of the galactic plane and moving northward at the moment. Not always, obviously, it'll probably oscillate.
I guess I wasn't sure when you said redefine the galactic plane.
Yeah, so we presently know those numbers, and we could essentially use the red line here, corrected for the Sun's motion out of the galactic plane. Yeah, and then forget about the location of the Sun at that point. Use Sagittarius A star's location to define zero of galactic latitude. It's an interesting thing. Galactic coordinates would change with time with this definition because we're going around the galaxy. Okay, but let me get back to the thread of the story here. Basically, after you remove the Sun's motion, which is known to very high accuracy, basically average 50,000 stars around you from Hipparchos data, and you find there's an average offset of 7.2 kilometers per second, and that's either the Sun moving up or all the other stars moving down, so you know, you assume it's the Sun. If you remove that from the data, you find a residual motion for Sagittarius A star in the direction perpendicular to the galactic plane of minus 0.4 plus or minus 0.9 kilometers per second. Now you should be very impressed by that uncertainty, 0.9 kilometers per second. That's a very slow speed, right? The Earth goes around the Sun at 30 kilometers per second. And if you go to the Smithsonian Museum at Dulles Airport, there's the Blackbird in there, spy plane, that actually has gone that fast. So military aircraft can do that. Okay, well, what does that tell us? Okay, first, there's some many reasons why Sagittarius A star should appear to be moving with respect to background quasars. Here's one interesting one. If we're here on the Sun in the middle of the Milky Way and there are other galaxies in the local group, M31, M33, and lots of others, they're essentially going to put torques on everything, and the spin axis of the Milky Way should precess. It should basically, the Milky Way should slowly tumble, and that would show up in this measurement. And I asked Scott Tremaine once how big that motion should be, and he said, well, it's going to be R naught times H naught. And I said, why? And he said, well, that's the only thing it could be. But apparently there are numerical simulations of this whole thing, and maybe people here know about them, that give you values of about that. So we would expect this tumbling motion of about 0.6 kilometers per second that would be buried in that measurement I said. So we're actually very close to being able to measure that. So that's one reason Sagittarius A star might be moving. Another possible reason is that there should be a cluster of dense stellar remnants that have sunk to the center of the Milky Way under dynamical friction. And they'll be perturbing Sagittarius A star. And here's a calculation basically of the one-dimensional speed you'd expect for a supermassive black hole perturbed by a cluster of dense stellar remnants near it in the galactic center. And this simulation has 5 times 10 to the 4th neutron stars and black holes in a Plummer distribution with core radii going from a milliparsec to 10 parsecs. On the vertical axis is the speed you would expect on average, an RMS speed in one dimension for Sagittarius A star. And you can see over quite a range of core radii, you'd expect a few tenths of a kilometer per second. So that's another reason Sagittarius A star should be moving. And finally, we know there's a dense stellar cluster around Sagittarius A star, and that should also be perturbing it. And this is kind of an interesting little calculation and an interesting little problem. There's a long story. I had a bet with Fred Razio about this. Basically, I thought at first that if you put an object or objects around a supermassive one, that the mass times the velocity of the supermassive object should roughly be equal to the mass times the velocity of the perturbing objects. After all, in the solar system, that's what happens. The sun is perturbed by Jupiter and the other planets in that manner. And Fred said, no, it's got to come into thermal equilibrium, and you have to have equipartition of kinetic energy. And anyway, we argued for a long time, and for some reason I was able to convince him that this was the answer. And we had a bet of dinner on that. And later on, I actually did a calculation, two calculations, an analytic one, which convinced me that it's this, and a numerical one, which I'll show you. And so I actually owed Fred two dinners, because he bought me one, and then I had to give him two. So basically what happens when you put lots of objects around one, you get a lot of random fluctuations, and you transition from equipartition of momentum to equipartition of kinetic energy. It's kind of a neat result. And so you can use this equation to calculate the mass of Sag A star if you know its velocity, the mass of the perturbing objects, and their velocities. So you can do it with that simple equation, or you can do it in a computer, which I did to convince myself of all of this. And it's actually a really simple calculation in the computer. You just take of order a million stars, which are observed in the galactic center region, put them around Sagittarius A star, and put them in orbit. So at time zero, they're starting in some position and moving in some direction, all random. And then you calculate an orbit segment for, say, 10 years later, which is roughly the time over which we've been observing Sagittarius A star. All the stars have moved on orbital arcs. The center of mass of all those stars has changed. In this closed system, that means the Sagittarius A star has to move to keep the center of mass constant. And if you do that calculation, you get a plot like this. Velocity of Sagittarius A star in one dimension, in kilometers per second, 2 kilometers, 1, 0, as a function of the mass of Sagittarius A star. And here is our 1 sigma error limit for the motion of Sagittarius A star. There are 3 curves on there for 3 different stellar mass functions. I don't want to go into details about that. It's believed the stars in the galactic center have a very top-heavy mass function. And so probably the answer is between this green one and this outer one here. But in any event, at 0.9 kilometers per second, the maximum likelihood mass for Sagittarius A star is greater than 0.4 times 10 to the 6th solar masses. In other words, its lack of motion is telling you it has at least 10% of the mass that's sensed by the infrared orbits. Undoubtedly most of it. Okay, so as I mentioned, no. These are stars within the gravitational sphere of influence. They're orbiting Sagittarius A star.
Okay, but that's going to be of order of million solar masses, right?
Yeah. In fact, I made the mass about the same as the mass.
So most of those stars are older stars, not young stars.
Probably.
Okay. So what was the comment about the top heavy iron thing?
You're getting off my field of expertise. People tell me when they look in the galactic center, they see a top-heavy IMF. And there are clusters near the galactic center that do have that. By old stars, they don't have to be, which I guess you're thinking of as many billions of years old.
Right, it's like
yeah, if they're massive stars, they can't be that old. So I think they're... You're talking stars that are 100 million years old, typically, B-type stars. Okay, I'm not an expert on that part of it. Just to show you, the data I showed you earlier went from here down to 2003. We've taken data in 2007. It's going right down that straight line, so nothing is changing there. So to summarize all this stuff...
The scatter stuff.
Yeah, the scatter down there is better. Yeah, that's this calibration improvement that I was talking about. Exactly right. So, as I said, the infrared stellar orbits give you these numbers, dark mass of 4 million solar masses within 50 astronomical units. The radio observations, when you have those infrared observations, you can then infer that the mass of Sagittarius A star is at least 10% or so of that sensed by the infrared orbits. But the observed size of Sagittarius A star is very small. It's less than half an astronomical unit. And so if you put those two numbers together, you find, first of all, that the dark mass sensed by the infrared orbit is tied to the luminous source, Sagittarius A star, and these numbers give you a density now of 10 to the 22nd solar masses per cubic parsec, which is indeed overwhelming evidence for a supermassive black hole. And just to sort of give you examples of other numbers that have been put forward for black hole mass densities, there was a lot of hoopla from the Space Telescope many years ago for M87, which gave a mass density of only 10 to the 6 solar masses per cubic parsec. Actually, it's only comparable to a globular cluster. There's the water masers in NGC 4258, which I don't have time to talk about, which give a much higher density of 10 to the 10th solar masses per cubic parsec. The infrared stellar orbits, as I mentioned, gave you 10 to the 17th. You add in the lack of motion of Sagittarius A star and its size, you get to 10 to the 22nd. And by way of comparison, a 4 million solar mass black hole within 3 Schwarzschild radii would have a density of 10 to the 24th. So logarithmically, we're of course getting very, very close here.
Is that 0.5 AU size, is that coming from the latest VLBI measurements, or where is that?
I'm going to point that out. Yeah, that's a very conservative interpretation of the latest numbers. So, 3 Schwarzschild radii at the galactic center's distance is about 30 microarc seconds. And we can envision clearly in the future with a VLB array of lots of telescopes working at just below 1 millimeter wavelength, including ALMA and other telescopes. Those have fringe spacings of 20 microarc seconds. So well within 3 Schwarzschild radii. And as was just asked, there are some very recent VLBI data between Hawaii and Arizona and actually California at 1.3 millimeter wavelength, which has a fringe spacing of 60 microarc seconds, that have detected Sagittarius A star. If you detect something with an interferometer, basically it has to have emission smaller than the fringe spacing. And so there definitely is emission coming from Sagittarius A star that's coming from within 3 Schwarzschild radii in size. Okay. Intermediate mass black holes. That's an interesting topic in the galactic center. There's this problem, I'm sure you've heard of it, it's called the paradox of stellar youth. There are some very young stars seen very close in to the galactic center. And it's thought that they couldn't form in situ because if you take a gas cloud and put it in a strong gravitational potential, it's going to shear itself to death before you form a star. And so people have hypothesized that you form stars farther out, you drag them in by dynamical friction, but you need something to hold them together, otherwise they'll just disperse. And maybe intermediate mass black holes exist in dense stellar clusters that are being dragged into the galactic center. If there were a fairly massive intermediate mass black hole very close to Sagittarius A star, it would move it. Depending on how far away it is, it might show up as a motion in Sagittarius A star. If it's pretty tightly bound to Sagittarius A star, then it would basically show up as a sort of short-term position noise in our data. And here is our data after taking out the motion of Sagittarius A star in right ascension versus time and declination versus time. The dashed lines sort of give you limits. And just to give you a quick answer, this sort of data can exclude an intermediate mass black hole greater than about 10 to the 4th solar masses between radii of 1,000 and 10 to the 5th astronomical units from Sagittarius A star. Okay, let me move on here. Okay, here's a cute picture I found on the web. It's done by Thomas Lucas, which is not Lucas of movie fame. It's a gravitational ray tracing calculation of what the Milky Way would look like if you were inside of Sagittarius A star. And the thing that interested me most about this picture is not that, you know, gee, it must be really complicated to calculate all the ray tracing in GR and get it right. The real problem is that the major uncertainty in that image is we don't know what the Milky Way looks like. So it's not GR.
Here's a question on your previous slide. Like for 10 to 4 solar mass, medium mass black hole, you gave a range of radii. But,
yeah, any within that range, we would have detected it as excursions in motion bigger than those.
Oh, I see. So that's over the entire range?
Yeah, right. That's right. If you put it in...
A very low, small radii, is it?
When if it's too small a radius, it would only perturb things a little bit because it's so close. It's a tight binary orbit, and the excursions would be small. If you put it more than 10 to the fifth AU out, then I think it ends up not pulling enough on it to do it. So you can read our paper on this, and also you need this paper here by Hansen and Milosevic. Okay. So, what does our galaxy look like? We all know if you go out and look at it at night, maybe you can see it in Santa Barbara. Can't see it in Boston. You see something like that. What does it look like? What does it really look like? Well, who knows? It may look like one of those two things. We don't really know. So, what we really need to do in order to solve this problem and figure out what the Milky Way looks like, at least what the spiral structure looks like, the bright young stars that are in spiral arms, is we need to measure distances to young stars which trace spiral arms. And we have to do that at radio wavelengths because we have to look through all the dust in the galaxy. Yes. So, a brief interlude here. I looked up the history of parallax measurements, and it's really very interesting. There's a great book, by the way, called Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. You can't read it down at the bottom here because it's blocked. It's by Alan Hirschfeld. It's out of print, but if you go to, you know, any of the online booksellers, you can get a new copy essentially for $3. I highly recommend the book. It's great reading. In any event, starting about the time of the Copernican Revolution, the desire to measure stellar parallax was essentially the holy grail of astronomy. Everybody wanted to do it, and there were two reasons which were given up there. First, it proved that the Earth went around the Sun. If the Sun went around the Earth, there wouldn't be any parallax. So it proved a heliocentric cosmology. And second, it would basically give you the distances to the stars, which at that point would give you the size of the universe. That's what we knew, all they knew at that time. Those are two pretty good questions in the 1600s. And essentially, every astronomer that we've ever heard of tried to measure parallax. Here are just a few names: Tycho Brahe, Galileo, Robert Hooke, Bradley, Herschel. They all tried to do it. They all failed. And basically, it was the result of these two men that the first stellar parallax was measured. So the picture here is of Joseph Fraunhofer of Fraunhofer lines. He has an amazing story. I'll just spend 2 minutes to tell you this story. It's just unbelievable. He was one of, I think, 12 or 13 children in a family of a guy who was a glazier, no money, no education at all. When he was 10, his mother fell down some stairs and died. And when he was 11, his father died. He was orphaned. And so he was sent to work with a guy who made glass. And as sort of an indentured servant, he was supposed to be educated, but the guy didn't send him to school, so he had no education. It turned out that this was in Munich. A few years later, the building that they were working in collapsed and killed the glassmaker's wife. The glassmaker wasn't in the building, so he wasn't injured. Fraunhofer was in the building. And he got under something, a table or something, that was strong enough to withstand the building collapse. And it was kind of a big thing in Munich at that point, and a lot of people came down to look, try and pull through the material to, they heard his voice in there to try to rescue him. And the prince in Munich, Maximilian Joseph, was down there with a businessman friend of his, and they saw them pull Fraunhofer out alive. And at that point, he sort of took him under his wing and had him educated. It's just kind of amazing. That building hadn't fallen on him, he would have been nothing. And he was then sent to work with a lens maker and learned a lot about lenses. And ultimately, he became the best lens maker and best telescope maker in the world. He died very young at age 39 of tuberculosis. And in his last couple of years, he knew he was dying. He made his last telescope for Bessel. Bessel wanted a very special telescope made to try to measure stellar parallax. And so in 1838, Bessel was the first to measure a stellar parallax to 61 Cygni, of about a third of an arc second. And the bottom number there in parenthesis comes from Hipparchos. That's the modern value, good to a milliarc second. So he did a really good job. So it's really a fantastic story. Wish I could have more time to tell you about it. And of course, if you skip 100 and some odd years of photographic plates and other parallaxes, you get to Hipparchos, which measured roughly 100,000 stellar parallaxes to about a milliarc second accuracy. But a milliarc second accuracy gives you 10% distance at a tenth of a kiloparsec. It's really just the solar neighborhood. Doesn't really tell you anything about the structure of the Milky Way. But it's a great, you know, obviously a great result, the Hipparchos survey. So I don't know why I put this slide up here, but basically here's what we try to do. We try to measure stellar parallax to masers, molecular maser sources associated with star-forming regions. So massive stars, around massive stars, you have masers. And we measure the positions of these masers against background quasars, so they are absolute parallaxes. And when one does this, a byproduct is you get the proper motion because you have to solve for that in addition to the parallax. So you have all six phase space dimensions. You know where the thing is in distance and position exactly, and you know its proper motion and its radial velocity from Doppler shifts. You know everything about where it is. Turns out to give you a wealth of information. So here's sort of how the data can be displayed, how parallax data can be displayed. I'm going to show you a few examples only, so that's why I'm going to just give you a parallax 101 talk here. So one way to look at parallax data is you look at a picture of the sky, north up, east to the left, and what you expect to see is the Earth's orbit giving you an ellipse on the sky depending on the projection of the Earth's orbit as seen by the source, plus the proper motion of the source, and you get these funky little curly Q motions on the sky for a parallax. I don't like looking at those plots at all. Another way is to look at, for example, the eastward and northward components versus time. And here's for a parallax measurement you might get in the eastward motion, which has the sinusoidal term from the Earth's orbit, plus the proper motion in it. If you design your observations very carefully, you can get essentially no correlation between the proper motion measurement and the parallax measurement. And so you can take out the slope, basically, without affecting anything in your parallax measurement. And that's the data shown on the right there. And that's the type of data I like to look at least. So let me show you what some real looks like. So the Orion Nebula Cluster, sort of the archetypal star-forming region in the Milky Way because it's fairly close. We've measured the parallax to this. There are four stars that are circled on this picture of the Orion region. This is the trapezium down here. Theta 1A Orionis is circled there. It has a companion, a low-mass Titari-like star that gives off non-thermal radio emission, which we can use as an astrometric target, and then there's a star up here, one here. If you plot the eastward motion of these stars versus time, the tick marks are 2 milliarcseconds between the labeled tick marks, and the time period here is a year and a half. You see the right ascension going up, down, up, and down, exactly as it should do for the parallactic effect from the Earth. The declination motion is shown on the bottom. Most often we try to ignore the deck motion. We try to measure only at the peaks of the right ascension motion, which are out of phase with the deck ones. There are many reasons. The declination effect is usually smaller. Our errors in declination are usually bigger, and so basically often adds very little to our parallax measurement. So we plan it that way. If you want to know the distance to the Orion Nebula Cluster, it is 414 plus or minus 7 parsecs. from that parallax data.
What do you use for your dark
ones? A quasar.
Can you see it?
No. It's about a degree away. And this is, let's see, what are we talking about here? That's an arc minute from here to here. So it's 60 times further away.
Is it easy to see what it is about the geometry that makes the motion smaller
than that? If it's something bigger, we'll move it off, right?
Yeah. Let me not explain that now, okay?
Isn't that right?
Can I put it more subtle?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's not go. Let me go. Here are three other measurements that were done with VLBI techniques. Giving, if you can read the numbers at the bottom, they all agree within their statistical uncertainties with our measurement. And it turns out that there's one group in Japan that's trying to do the same sort of things we're doing. They do a pretty good job too. And they've just put out a preprint that gives 418 plus or minus 6. So they claim to beat us in the uncertainty by one parsec. But you know, yeah, you can trust those numbers. They're really very good.
You all use the same reference source?
Yes, I think so in that case.
And you all use the same water vapor calibration?
No, that's different now. This was done with non-thermal emission from accretion disks and magnetic activity in T-Tauri stars. That's our measurement. The Sandstrom measurement is the same. It was using only this star. And this Harata, I don't know if you can see us down here, the Vera measurement was from water masers that are right in here. So whether you use masers or non-thermal emission from stars, you get the same answer.
So is there any idea, so the depth of the cluster is like a parsec?
The depth of the dense star forming region is an arc minute at that distance, which I think is about a parsec, yeah. Yeah, you can't get depth yet from this. I mean, the whole Orion region is big and has depth, but not the active star forming region. Okay, boy, am I running out of time. Okay, Milky Way parallaxes. Okay, here's an interesting case. This was actually our first fairly accurate and distant parallax measurement. Here's a Spitzer infrared image of a star forming region. Here's W30H, which is a nice strong maser source. The interesting thing about this source is it has a photometric distance from nearby O stars that wouldn't show up quite on this picture of about 2 kiloparsecs. It has a kinematic distance, which I'll describe in a second, of about 4 kiloparsecs. So there's a problem there. Kinematic distances, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. Let me mention it. You can determine the distance to an object if you measure a Doppler shift and know something about the rotation of the Milky Way. And basically it goes like this. Here's a plan view of the Milky Way, galactic center here, the sun here, the local standard of rest moving in a circle at theta naught speed, and the sun has some peculiar motion. If you want to measure the distance to this object out here, assume it's moving in a circular orbit also, then you can get a distance. And basically, you get a Doppler shift, which is the difference in the Doppler shifts between the sun and the object. You have a model for galactic rotation, which has a lot of parameters in it, the distance to the galactic center, the rotation speed, the solar peculiar motion, which I haven't listed there. The galactic longitude, which is, of course, easy to measure, and you adjust the distance until this thing matches that thing, and you get a distance. Okay. We'll get back to that in just a second. Here's the parallax data for W30H. Now we're talking pretty small angles. Look at the one on the right, the one I like to look at. Half a milliarc second between the two major tick marks. The solid line is the right ascension parallax data, and the dashed line is the declination data. In this case, the source is almost looking face-on on the Earth's orbit, and so we actually measured both components. You can see they all fit very well, and you get a parallax of 0.5 milliarc seconds with an uncertainty of 10 micro arc seconds. So, what does this tell us about W30H? Here's that same plan view of the Milky Way. The sun is here. The parallax distance puts it here. The photometric distance from the associated O stars pretty close to it, and the kinematic distance way out in left field. there. So there's clearly a problem with the kinematic distance for this object, about a factor of two. And the reason for it is that this star-forming region has a large peculiar velocity, independent of its orbit in the galaxy. That arrow there is the peculiar velocity of W3OH, which is about 22 kilometers per second, happens to be aimed at the sun. And that's why it all shows up as a Doppler shift and why the kinematic distance is all wrong. Okay, I'm just going to, here's another source, S252. Same sort of parallax data at the right. Let me just skip through this. It gives a similar parallax as 0.48 milliarc seconds with a 10 microarc second uncertainty. So here's a collection of about a dozen or so sources for which we now have trigonometric parallaxes. Here was W3OH, the one I mentioned. S252 I showed you was over there. It's on a schematic model of the Milky Way, which may or may not have any accuracy. It dates from the 70s, basically, by Georgelin and Georgelin. Okay, so we have lots of them. Our goal is, of course, to trace out the spiral arms. It looks like we're starting to trace out the Perseus spiral arm here pretty well. We'd like to be able to trace out the inner arms also. And it looks like there's an outer arm out here.
How are you choosing this? Whatever you can see, or is it?
We started basically with the ones that are easiest to measure. And now we're actually targeting, you know, trying to get sources in this region and in this region out here. Yeah. So now I'm putting on the kinematic. I took the names off and put the kinematic distances on. So the dark blue there are kinematic distances, and the cyan circles are the real distances, the parallaxes. You can see there's a big problem in kinematic distances for almost all the sources. It tends to be fairly systematic. Most of them have kinematic distances that greatly exceed their true distances. You could try to solve this in two ways. You could shrink the galaxy, which will shrink a kinematic distance linearly. Or you could actually increase the rotation speed of the Milky Way, which also does about the same thing to a kinematic distance. So that's your first thought. Let's fix it up by doing that. But you should remember one thing. Sagittarius A star's proper motion gives you the ratio of theta naught to r naught of 29.5 kilometers per second per kiloparsec, which I mentioned earlier. So if you like 8 kiloparsecs for the distance to the galactic center, the galaxy is spinning at 236 kilometers per second. If you like 8.5 kiloparsecs, it's going at 251 kilometers per second. So we could try the latter one, for example, see what happens. So what I've done here now is I've transformed to a rotating frame, rotating with the galaxy. I've picked at first the IAU values for r naught and theta naught, and the arrows are the peculiar motions, the non-circular motions for all these objects. And those error bars are big. There's a 10 kilometer per second error bar down here at the lower left, if you can see. These things are 20 and 30 kilometers per second. It's a big number. Not what one would have thought for massive star-forming regions. And you can see they're clearly systematic. Most of them point to the left and a fair fraction toward the galactic center. So if you change to better numbers for the galactic constants, you change the vectors a little bit, but not enough. I'll go back and forth once or twice. You'll see the arrows get a little better. That's the IAU values. These are better values. So you fix things up a little bit, but you still have all the systematic arrows going to the left. So what can we do? Well, one thing we're free to do is to solve for a solar motion. The sun is moving and not in a circular orbit. And if we solve for a solar motion with this data, we get these values. I'll explain UV and W in a second. And you can see that many of those arrows have gone to near zero. So that seems to fix up a big part of the problem. There still is a significant population of about a third of the sources that have big vectors that are going more or less toward the galactic center. So let's look at these solar motion values. Okay, Hipparchos determined the solar motion values very well. Basically, you look at 50,000 stars around the sun. As I say, you average all three components of the motion and you get the solar motion out of it. Here are the two that work really well. The U component on the top is the direction toward the galactic center. The W component is out of the plane of the Milky Way toward the North Galactic Pole. For the Hipparchos data, they plot it as a function of stellar dispersion for different groups of stars, which is just colors or ages. The older stars have bigger stellar dispersions, the younger stars have less stellar dispersion. And you can see that our measurements in U and W agree very well with the Hipparchos values. And of course, Sagittarius A star's proper motion, if it is stationary at the galactic center, gives you the W component also, and it agrees with the Hipparchos measurement. All is well and good. Yes. So now we go to the V component. This is the hard one. When you try to measure the solar motion in the direction of galactic rotation, when you're measuring it from a source that's moving in the direction of galactic rotation. And so here's the same sort of plot for the V component. The Hipparchos data gives you this. That's called the asymmetrical drift. Since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to explain it. It's in all of the astronomy textbooks. But basically, if you have a source of objects you're using that have a high dispersion, you will measure a component of the rotation of the galaxy in the solar motion, but complicated. So what one does is one extrapolates to zero stellar dispersion and calls that the solar motion, basically defining the local standard of rest at about 5 kilometers per second. There is this one point in the Hipparchos data, which are the youngest group of stars they have, the late B-type stars, that they point out doesn't fall on the asymmetrical drift. And then there's our data point there in red. And so basically ours are basically zero age. These are 1,000-year-old stars. And so we'll call it zero dispersion on this plot. And so basically what it's saying is that stars are born moving, rotating, or orbiting the galaxy about 13 kilometers per second, the difference between here and here, slower than the galaxy spins. As they age, they go down, and you get to the late B-type stars at about 100 million years for a characteristic age. And then they ultimately join this asymmetrical drift at a few hundred million years old. And then their orbits get perturbed as they bump into things going around the Milky Way, and they walk back up this asymmetrical drift curve. So this was kind of an interesting result, that massive star-forming regions, and perhaps all stars, are born orbiting the galaxy slower than it spins.
You live in a much bigger area than you part of this, right?
Yes.
So is this connection really that obvious, or the leap of faith here?
Okay, the Hipparchos, it's a totally different way of measuring things. Yeah, the Hipparchos just says, define the local standard of rest as all the stars within 100 parsecs. Average them, and that's the local standard of rest. What we're doing is an absolute measurement against quasars.
But you're trying to minimize something, so you're trying to minimize...
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, I shouldn't be trying to solve for the solar motion with this because we're in a big enough part of the galaxy. What I'm claiming is that star-forming regions orbit slower. They have on the previous plots, a leftward arrow. And if you have a big enough piece of the Milky Way, that leftward arrow is going to bend as you go around the galaxy. And so this is, in some sense, not the optimum thing to do. But it does show you what's going on in general. I don't think there's any problem in mixing this. The reason I show you this is that the Hipparchos data gave a hint that there was something funny going on with young stars, which they sort of ignored. And our data shows it's a definitely real. So
if you were to get the kinematic distances to stars like the Sun, you wouldn't have this problem. But if you're trying to get it to very young stars, you have the problem.
Yeah, the Sun would be up here someplace. Because it's an old star, it has a high dispersion of about 20 kilometers per second. So it would be at 400 actually, 20 squared. It would be here.
That's the last thing. Why you form stars?
Okay. Let me give you a possibility here. Given spiral density wave theory, why how could this happen? Okay. Let's say you have a planned view of the Milky Way again. Galactic center here. Let's say the Sun's here. And let's say you have a blue dot there, which is a molecular cloud. And it's orbiting, let's put it on a circular orbit, this blue orbit here. And if it encounters a spiral arm or something, it'll give it a shock and kick it backwards. And spiral arms are thought to, they're waves that go around the galaxy at roughly half the rotation speed. So that should happen. If it hits it in that way, and if it can remove angular momentum from the orbit, then it's going to change from a circular orbit to an elliptical orbit, and it would be at apocenter and would be orbiting slower at that point. So one then ends up with that scenario. You come in, remove angular momentum, you are then orbiting slower by, in our case, we think 13 kilometers per second. Go into an elliptical orbit, which would be actually kind of nice because it might keep it in the spiral arm a bit longer. And the shock of hitting a spiral arm is thought to compress the gas and form stars. Now let me give you a problem, though. And this is something I've never understood, and I've asked lots of people, and there are a lot of good theoreticians here. Everything I told you there will work for gas. Gas can respond to shocks or magnetic fields if that's what's doing it. But they, you know, and gas can also respond to gravity. Stars can only respond to gravity. You know, shocks are meaningless to a star, and magnetic fields are meaningless. So if replace this thing now with this blue thing with a star entering a spiral arm, what happens? You will find arm wavy stuff in the literature, if you go back to the old papers on spiral density wave theory, that say, well, in order to maintain the spiral arm, it has to move inward and toward the galactic center to keep it in the spiral arm a little bit longer to reinforce the spiral wave. But gravity works the opposite way. If you're coming inward and encounter that spiral arm, you're going to be accelerated toward it. That's going to add angular momentum. If you're on a circular orbit to begin with, the only thing it can do is go to a bigger orbit. And that would make it move outward and not inward. And so I don't see how old stars, I don't see how old stars can participate in spiral density waves. So I'd love someone to explain to me why I'm have a problem with this.
I thought the amplitude of the spiral arm pattern in, say, red light, infrared, is much smaller.
Yeah, but they say a third of, you know, the density is from old stars in the literature. At least that's what I've read. You know, so I don't know what's going on there. Great problem. Sort of a problem that's been buried for 30 years. Okay, got it.
What's the soul of this spiral pattern problem right now?
Yeah, good one. Okay, well, I should be finished now. I have about 5 or 10 minutes here on local group proper motion, which probably will interest you more than the rest of this talk. So if you're patient, I'll try to go through this. Okay, local group proper motions have a long history also. In the 1920s, Adrian von Manen claimed to measure the rotation of M33. And here's a plate from his 1920s APJ paper. There are a lot of little arrows on there, if you can see them. They all sort of point clockwise, which is the wrong direction for that galaxy spinning. And he measured sort of 10 milliarcsecond per year motions and said that therefore spiral nebulae had to be galactic objects. And actually, Harlow Shapley believed that thought that they the wrong side of the argument with Hubble and Curtis. Hubble, of course, argued for more distant more bigger distances for extragalactic, for spiral nebulae, and of course he was right. And von Manen's error actually has never really been found. So we've been actually able to do the von Manen experiment. This was Andreas Brunthaler's PhD thesis, started a few years ago. And there are several water masers in M33. One is called IC-133 here, which is expected to be moving in this direction. And one is M33-19, it's called, which is expected to be moving in that direction. We can't measure parallax to an object this distance. It's just too far for our techniques right now. But proper motions And the proper motion accuracy goes down with time as a 3/2 power. If you ask me, I can explain that if it's not obvious to you. So you gain with a longer time baseline quite quickly. And so we've been able to see two things. We've been able to see M33 spin in angle, and we've been able to see it move across the sky because we measure this against background quasars. So let me quickly show you some data. This is the M33-19 maser, the eastward motion in milliarc seconds, 0.2.4, versus time over a couple of years there, about 4 years. You can see a nice progression there with an uncertainty of about 4 microarcseconds per year. So the VLBA measurements give you a difference between the two water masers in the different parts of the galaxy of 30 microarc seconds east-west and 10 microarc seconds north-south. If you look at H1 data, you can get the inclination of the galaxy and from Doppler shifts the spin. And it predicts that the velocity in the east-west direction, the difference should be 106 kilometers and 35 in declination. You divide one by the other and you get a distance. And so you can get a distance, a geometric distance here, of 750 kiloparsecs for M33. An uncertainty of 50 kiloparsecs comes from the proper motion measurements. Actually, the dominant uncertainty comes from uncertainty in the model of the rotation from the H1 data. And Andreas is busy right now trying to get a better rotation model from newer data and also to add a third maser. And we think that we can get down to a 10% geometric distance to M33 in the future. Okay, let's go to its motion across the sky now. Instead of differencing the two maser sources, you basically add them up. You correct them for rotation to the galactic center. You remove the sun's motion around the Milky Way, and you combine both results, and at the bottom here, you get that M33's proper motion is minus 100 kilometers per second toward the east, and plus 156 kilometers per second toward the north on the sky. So, in sort of schematic, this is what it looks like. Here's the Milky Way we're observing from over here. Here's Andromeda, M31. And here's M33, and it's moving in this direction, almost toward Andromeda, as it should be if it's a satellite of Andromeda. Okay. Sorry?
Could go now as well.
It could have been, yeah. But it isn't. That's what it's doing. Okay. Now, here's a nice three-body problem. If we had we have M33's Doppler shift, it's coming toward us. If we had M31, Andromeda. If we had Andromeda's proper motion, we could calculate the histories of these three bodies. Well, you can try to do it in the following manner. You can assume or guess a proper motion for Andromeda, M31, like, let's say, zero. You have to put in the amount of the dark matter halos for the galaxies in order to calculate the orbits, the histories of these things. And if we adopted these in this paper down here a few years ago. And you can calculate the history of what happens. And I won't bore you with a very complicated plot of everybody's motion in every plane here. Look at the plot on the bottom. The green line is let's go to the red line first. The red line is, this is now, and this is 10 gigayears ago. If M33 was approaching and almost hit Andromeda, did it again as it orbited with that case. And even more embarrassingly, the Milky Way about 8 gigayears ago also hit Andromeda. So something's wrong with that picture. Had that happened, M33 would not exist, and the Milky Way and Andromeda would be quite different also. Something is wrong with those assumptions. Okay, so let's examine the first assumption. The first assumption is that M31 Andromeda has no proper motion. So let's try to change that. And what we did basically is we ran an n-body code, a very simple thing. We made a disk for M33. We did trial values of the proper motion of Andromeda, which specifies the whole system, ran it in time, and saw what happened. If we used zero proper motion for Andromeda, M33's disk, which started out as a perfect disk, looked like that in three dimensions at the end, which is not what M33 looks like. If we used 100 kilometer per second proper motions for Andromeda in two dimensions, we got this back, which, in other words, the disk that we put in was recovered. So that's a perfectly legitimate solution. It preserves M33 as a nice disk galaxy. With 50 kilometer per second motions, you sort of get an intermediate result. So basically, this says that Andromeda has to have a significant proper motion in order to for M33 to be a nice disk galaxy today. But as I mentioned, there's one other assumption, and that's the amount of dark mass that we put in this calculation. So what we did is we tried using 75% of the previous values for the dark matter halos for these two galaxies. So for Andromeda, we used 2.6 times 10 to the 12th solar masses, and for the Milky Way, 1.7. And if you look at the bottom plots again, now things look a little better. The green one, which is the Milky Way and Andromeda, they never interact. And it also satisfies the timing argument that basically, just barely in this case, that the two galaxies were closer together a long time ago when the universe was young than they are now. But still, M33 encountered, went well within the dark matter halo of Andromeda about 4 or 5 billion years ago, and that would be enough, again, to significantly distort the galaxy, and it probably didn't happen.
Total mass of M33?
M33. It doesn't make much difference, and I can't remember the numbers.
I guess if it was very massive, then the orbit could change quite a bit because of dynamical friction.
Yeah, there's no dynamical friction in this calculation, which would make matters worse for its survival. It's a very conservative assumption. If there were dynamical friction, it's more likely to get in and get close to Andromeda and get destroyed. But its mass makes very little difference.
Its mass has remained constant with time.
For M31 and the Milky Way, correct. For M33, we did put in test particles in this calculation, and if they went away, then we reduced the mass of M33.
I like to think years ago that mass for Milky Way was the same.
Yeah, this is simple. I mean, what you guys do these days is just, orders of magnitude better than this. This is just sort of to get you an idea of what's happening.
So are there no lasers in M31 or
whatever? There aren't. People have looked. M31, Andromeda. Andromeda just does not have the strong masers that M33 has. Now, it's a big galaxy on the sky. It covers a lot of, and so it's very hard to survey. And these things are weak. So the whole galaxy has not been surveyed yet. But certainly all the likely, giant H2 regions have been surveyed, and no masers have been found yet. We dearly would like to find one.
Okay.
It does have a very weak AGN. And it's possible in the future, with advances with the VLBA and big telescopes, that we could use the nucleus of Andromeda to measure its motion, which would probably be the best way to do it. So it's got a core. It's like Sag A star,
right.
But it's I think the number is like a 100 microjanskis in strength at radio wavelengths.
Radio wavelength.
And that's that.
So it's not active.
No, it's a very—it's like the Milky Way, a very inactive AGN. Yeah, low luminosity AGN is another word, or a low, very, very, very low luminosity AGN.
Who prefer the low to refer to like a 1040 Hz per second?
Yeah. Minimal. Right. No, we're way below that.
Way below
that. Right. So I wanted to point one thing. This is basically the end of the talk. And that is this theta naught over R naught value, which we've now measured of 29.5 kilometers per second for the Milky Way, depending what you use for R naught, but it is almost surely between 8 and 8.5 kiloparsecs, gives a much higher rotation speed than the IAU value And so basically the dark matter halo of the Milky Way is probably comparable to that of Andromeda. So we probably should have used a bigger number here, which makes matters worse in these calculations. So.
If it were a maser in Andromeda, you wouldn't be able to measure the heck out of the Andromeda proper margin, is what I'm getting from.
Yeah, well, we'd be all over it. Yeah.
But it's definitely, your prediction is it's not zero.
That's right. We think Andromeda is probably moving about 100 kilometers per second tangentially on the sky. And so, in the next 5 years, what are we hoping to do? Three things, basically. We want to measure the galactic parameters, R0 and theta-0, from parallaxes and proper motions. And we think we can do it with about 3% accuracy in the next few years. We want to map the spiral structure of the Milky Way, at least the northern portion. The southern portion is going to have to await having some better telescopes in the south. And we want to critically test spiral density wave theory, which, as I pointed out to you, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And finally, we are doing several other local group galaxies trying to measure their proper motions. We are currently doing IC-10 and NGC-253. And we're going to try to do maybe one or two others, possibly Andromeda, if we can get our sensitivity up and use its very weak AGN, and do a lot in terms of the local group dynamics. So sorry for running way over it, but there you go. Still questions? Okay, shoot.
So what are the chances of getting a VLBA in the southern hemisphere? And
does
LMC have masers?
LMC has some masers that could be done. We could measure the distance to the LMC with a good array in the south. That's correct. Okay, what are the chances? Let's see, how to put this. There is a sensitive subject about what's going to happen to the VLB array. I don't know if you've heard the NSF rumblings. Basically, NSF has a problem. They've built ALMA, a third of ALMA, and since in bed with ESO, ESO runs things in a very lavish fashion, and they've agreed to run ALMA in a lavish fashion. So they need $30 million per year to run the 30% of ALMA that we're going to get. Okay. Basically, the NSF Astronomy Department Division has roughly a $200 million budget, of which 120 or 30 million is sort of available in play. So 30 million out of 120 is a big amount, right? So something's got to give.
Give up the Mercedes budget for ALMA.
Sorry?
The Mercedes budget for ALMA.
That's right. Well,
a million bucks for Mercedes cars a year from.
Okay. I don't want to badmouth this too much. So they commissioned this august body headed by Roger Blanford, and they came up with a report saying, well, we ought to get rid of the VLBA and Arecibo if they can't come up with some money to run it independently. And we'll see what they do. I hope I've shown you that we're doing some pretty neat things with the VLB array. And it'd be a shame for $3 million a year, which is what they're looking for, to shut down the VLB array. Were they to do that, it would be interesting to try to raise $5 to $10 million and move a handful of those telescopes to Australia and continue this in the south. The other way this stuff will get done, the southern portion, will be the square kilometer array. Presumably will go in Australia. It'll have to be a VLBI type instrument for many reasons I can tell you. And that should be able to do a lot of this stuff depending what frequency range it goes to. But that's not going to happen for 20 years. And I'm not going to be around to see it. So.
You reckon that's going to Australia? The South Africans would argue differently.
They may, but I'm just giving you my guess. How's that? Yes, I think it's going to go to Western Australia.
Yeah, I think the Australian
government. I think main problem with the SKA is it's so sensitive if it's really a square kilometer array of collecting area, that you are confusion limited unless you have enough angular resolution to separate the zillions of things that are going to overlap on the sky. And so you need long baselines to do a lot of their work. And so they will need to make it an intercontinental array. So maybe they'll put a lot of it in Australia and a fraction of it in South Africa. and hook it all up together.
So AFCAP plus the existing Australian facilities won't do anything for
you? No, the existing Australian facilities, they have some telescopes with some long baselines. None of them work. The long baseline ones don't work at high frequencies where there are masers.
But if you use AFCAP for the long baselines?
AFCAP is a low frequency. It's an SKA.
10 gigahertz-ish, right?
I don't even think it's that, is it? I think it's one gigahertz. It's basically a low frequency demonstrator for the SKA. I don't know the top frequency range exactly, but it won't get up to. If it could get to 6.7 gigahertz, and if you can span Australia, you could do great work with parallaxes in the south. Yeah.
Is the LPA a dedicated thing? Or?
Yeah, dedicated array, right. That's the only reason we can do these things. If we used to do VLBI observations, like when, 20, 30 years ago, by going out to all the telescopes you're using, setting them up specially for this, taking the data, and a third of the time, something was not working because you had to set up a lot of complicated stuff and you got no feedback when you're observing. You're just tape recording your signals and a few weeks later you find out if you had anything. VLBA being dedicated, it's never taken apart, it's always running, it runs flawlessly. It's just a beautiful instrument. And so now, you just send in your schedule by email. 3 weeks later, you get, you can bring the data back over the internet or you can get DAT tapes and analyze your data, and it's fantastic. I mean, compared to when I did my thesis, it's in the 70s, it's a world of difference. Yeah.
Any questions?
No, I'll
walk again. And taking them off for dinner tonight.